This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. After a series of fatal accidents a few years ago, Connecticut passed laws aimed at keeping teen drivers safe. Since the first kid got behind the wheel of a car, it's been a challenge for parents and law enforcement. Car accidents are the single biggest cause of death for teens in America today. The CDC says that 16 to 19-year-olds are more likely to get into a car accident than at any other age. They're more likely to speed, underestimate dangerous situations, less likely to use their seatbelts. But it's not entirely their fault. See, scientists say a teenager's brain isn't fully developed until around age 25, leaving teens less able to reason, develop control over impulses, and make sound judgments. There are some things we can do to help teens learn to drive safely, though, including following the laws that restrict teens from activities that pose the greatest danger, things like driving with friends or late at night. We can teach parents the risks, how to prevent behaviors that lead to accidents. Even that means taking the car keys away. Today, Where We Live, we will talk to a dad who lost his son in a car accident 7 years ago and is using his experience to help others. We're talking about teenage drivers, the laws, the risks, and how to keep them safe. And we want to hear from you. Do you know how to help your teens stay safe in the car? You can call us at 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherewelive. First, we want to bring in Bill Seymour, who's a spokesman for the Department of Motor Vehicles, to talk about the laws that were passed a few years ago, what exactly is on the books, and how it has perhaps changed or helped things. Bill Seymour joins us. So welcome back to the show, Bill.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
So maybe you can lay out the laws that got passed back in 2008 that changed things for teen drivers in the state.
Well, in 2008, following a series of recommendations from a task force appointed by the governor, the legislature passed a number of laws that were tougher in terms of protecting the safety of teen drivers. For example, on the learner's permit, you had the person coming in for a learner's permit had to pass a 25-question knowledge test. Of course, later they would take a road test, but that learner's permit, while they had it, would prohibit them from carrying any other passengers in the car. That was relatively new at the time. Then when a person actually obtained a license, a 16 or a 17-year-old, the curfew was lengthened to it was 12 at midnight till 5 a.m., and it was lengthened to start at 11 p.m. As well, passenger restrictions, and we think that was one of the crown jewels of this task force recommendations. During the first 6 months, the newly licensed driver may not have any passengers in the vehicle except for a driving instructor or his or her parents or legal guardian, and one of them had to hold a driver's license or a person who was 20 years old who was teaching him how to drive. And then during the second 6 months, they were allowed to only have their siblings in the car, in other words, members of their immediate family. Then there was a seatbelt law put tightened with the teen drivers where they couldn't transport more passengers than the number of seatbelts in the vehicle. A 48-hour suspension for certain violations was including these teen driving violations, better known as the GDL violations, was put into effect where the police, upon issuing the summons, would give a 48-hour pull of the license, and the parents would need to come down to the police station to sign in order to get it back. There were also new training requirements put into effect, including on-the-road training, additionally, Connecticut became one of the first states, or the first state, I should say, in the country to offer, or to require, I should say, a 2-hour parent-teen program where the parents and the teens together had to go to a driving school to learn about safe practices when they drive, to learn about the GDL laws, and it was designed to encourage discussion between the teens and the parents, as well as to set a benchmark for learning about the laws. And this would be required of those trained at home as well as those in driving schools. In addition, fines and penalties were instituted and increased, actually. For example, if you violated any of the curfew or the passenger restriction laws, Your first offense was a 30-day suspension, followed by a now $175 license restoration fee, and then on your second offense, it was a 6-month suspension.
So there were a lot of laws passed at around the same time. A lot of things went into effect. I want to welcome in our panelists to sort of see how these laws have changed anything. Tim Hollister is an environmental and land use lawyer, and he's the author of a book called Not So Fast, Parenting Your Teen Through the Dangers of Driving. It's a byproduct of a nationally recognized blog from Reed's dad. His son died in a car accident, and we welcome him into the studio today. Thank you so much, Tim, for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
So listening to this long laundry list of bills that were passed, how effective do you think that they've been in the state over the course of the last few years, Tim?
Very effective. Bill can give you the exact number, but I think the round number is about a 40% reduction in crash rates over the last 5 years that the laws have been in effect, which puts Connecticut in the lead nationally, at least on a percentage basis. But I think the big picture is we went from having one of the most lenient teen driver laws in the country to having one of the strictest, and the results speak for themselves. Now, of course, we've had a horrific summer. Maybe we need to think about what has happened this summer and are there some additional adjustments that need to be made. But over the past 5 years, we've had a significant reduction in crash rates as a result of these laws. And I always say if I had a dollar for every parent that's thanked me as a member of the task force or has probably thanked the legislature and Governor Rell for their work on it.
And again, you were a member of the task force that came up with these laws. So maybe you can explain which pieces of all of this legislation are the most important to you. How did we arrive at these laws being the big changes that we saw?
There's no doubt that the two-hour required parent class – parents who have a learner's permit holder have to spend 2 hours at the driving school learning about the laws and about safety. That is far and away, in my mind, the single most important thing we did. We have a captive audience. There's a lot of grumbling, but now I think it's become an accepted part of the teen driving routine. And it just you can't put a value on that. Putting the parents in the same place with their teen, with a driving instructor, and learning what the laws are, that I think that's absolutely critical to our success. And second is the passenger restriction. What we've seen just over the past 10 weeks in Connecticut is, I believe it's 8 fatalities in the last 10 weeks, multiple teens in a car with a teen driver. That is a recipe for trouble, especially if it involves a so-called joyride where the kids are just out having fun in the car.
And we're going to talk more about those specifics because this is some very interesting work that you've done around this about what it means to have kids in the car and how many kids and whether or not they have a purpose in where they're going. This is an important part of our conversation. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Bill Seymour from the DMV, before I let you go, I just have to ask, when the laws went in place, it seemed as though they indeed did help. Do you think that the laws maybe need to be tightened once again? Have we learned something since 2008 that maybe we need to go back to the legislature and change or tighten some of these laws?
Well, you know, I think that's a study that remains yet to be done. When we look at the crashes over the summertime, there was just two that involved 16 or 17-year-old drivers. And these laws pertain to 16 or 17-year-old drivers. And of those two drivers, you had just one or only one fatality. Those other fatalities involved either passengers or they involved the drivers that were over 17. Whether we should be expanding this into the 18-year-old zone is a matter for debate by the legislature and others once we look at the data and take a strong, hard, examination of it. But what's clear is that we need to begin as much emphasis on passengers in the car as we do the drivers. And what I mean by that is we have to begin a statewide education outreach. I've been talking with people at Connecticut Children's about it, people at Yale New Haven about it, and seeing what we can do in order to mount a campaign and essentially get parents to educate their children that even though they're in the car, they are not just along for the ride.
Bill Seymour from the DMV, thank you so much for joining us for a few minutes. This is Where We Live, and we're talking about teen drivers, how to keep them safe, and I'm sure we want to hear from a lot of people at 860-275-7266 who want to join us. Mike's on a cell phone quickly. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a parent of a teen driver. My daughter has a learner's permit. I appreciate all the stuff, all the new protections that the state has put in, but I think there's one area where the state maybe has gone too far, and that's with learner's permits. When I was a teen driver many years ago learning to drive, anytime the family went out to dinner, went to the movies, went anywhere, I was the one that drove, and I'd have my mother, my father, my siblings in the car. Now, apparently, it can only be one parent and the teen driver with the learner's permit. And it makes it very difficult to take my daughter out driving to practice because I can't have my son in the car. My wife and I can't be in the car together with her. And I think that this is an area where it's difficult for kids to sometimes get on the roads. And now you have to have specially set times where you're going to go take your teen driver driving where the rest of the family is not going to be there.
Mike, thank you very much. Tim Hollister, quick response.
Sure. This is an issue that was debated on the task force at some length. The driving instructors who were on the task force said to us a driving lesson should be a driving lesson and should not be involve the distractions of siblings. And my friend Dave Preusser has a great quote. Do you trust and entrust your most precious cargo to your least experienced driver? Having siblings in the car while you're teaching your teen to drive is a very risky thing to do, even if you're there.
I want to bring into the conversation our two other panelists here in our studio. Chief Paul Melanson is the chief of police in Farmington. Thank you so much for joining us, sir. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
And Gary Lapidus is director of the Injury Prevention Center at Connecticut Children's Medical Center. He's joined us before, and it's good to see you again, Gary. Thank you very much for being here.
Pleased to be here.
I'm wondering if Gary, first, if you can speak to this from the medical professional standpoint. Why is this such an important issue, and how does the medical center get involved in this? Injury prevention in terms of childhood safety in the car. This is obviously something that's very important because you see the end result of a lot of this. But tell us how you're involved.
Well, at Connecticut Children's and Hartford Hospital, we are a level one trauma center, and motor vehicle crashes are a big reason why we are so busy. It is the leading cause of death for American teenagers, and there are clear reasons for this. It's due to driving inexperience and risk-taking behavior, and the fix for this, the medicine, the vaccine for this is graduated driver licensing systems. Graduated driver licensing systems phase in the driving privilege over a period of time, and it reduces the high-risk exposures that are key to car crashes. It reduces the risk for passengers when you have a lot of passengers in the car, and also it reduces the chances of nighttime crashes. The big issue right now is we have an effective medicine, an effective vaccine, but it's not completely adopted and understood by parents and teenagers, and it's very difficult for the police to enforce.
And I'm going to ask our police chief about that enforcement in just a moment, but I think a lot of our listeners will be interested in this idea of the medical community viewing this as a vaccine. Essentially, you've got the cure for this, but it needs to be widely adopted. Speak a little bit more to that, because often in the world of preventing death, preventing injury, preventing illness, we think of things in terms of medicine. What's the you know, prescription you can give? This is something a little bit different.
Yeah. So, for example, if you have high blood pressure and your doctor prescribes an antihypertensive medicine, high blood pressure medicine, and your doctor says, take these pills three times a day, every day. What we have now is a situation where we have an effective hypertension pill, graduated driver licensing, but a lot of people are only taking one pill a day instead of three pills a day. And until we can get all the people to understand graduated driver licensing and comply with it, we're not going to have maximum effect. We have shown in our studies and elsewhere that the system has reduced car crashes in our state 40%. That's an amazing thing, but we can do much better than that.
I want to ask Chief Blanson about the enforcement aspect. How difficult is it to enforce these laws? What would make your life a little bit easier?
It is very difficult to enforce because a lot of these laws are not what we would call a primary violation. In other words, they're not something that we can witness. Obviously, a speeding car, somebody going through a red light, you can see right away. Whether somebody had their license for a year or a year and a day is very difficult when you're a police officer observing a teen drive by. So that's why it becomes very difficult for us. And what we find is most of the time these laws are enforced after a violation. So we catch somebody speeding or somebody went through a red light or there's an accident and they had somebody in the car. That's when we find that these laws are mostly enforced. What would help, there had been talk when this law was passed about trying to come up with a sticker system, something which would warn or notify police officers that a person's not allowed to have anybody in the car. So there were things that we discussed, and you know, that becomes difficult for parents, because if it's a permanent sticker and now their senior is driving the car, that may mean, and with a friend, that may mean that their senior student would get stopped. So there are pros and cons to that, but it has been discussed.
We put a lot of other stickers on our cars. We put stickers about how your kid did well in school, or about the fact that he's on the rugby team. It seems as though it might make sense to put another sticker on the car. Gary, I know you want to jump in.
Yeah, so I absolutely agree with the police chief, because for them to figure this out, they have to have a traffic stop and actually look at the license to figure out who's who. So the answer to this, and what other European, Asian countries, Canada, Australia, and even the state of New Jersey has implemented a decal law. It's a little tiny red decal that goes on the license plate. Police officers are trained to look at license plates, and that easily identifies who's a novice teen driver and who's not. And there's just been a very careful study that looked at whether or not this works. And what they found in New Jersey, there was a 14% increase in police citations, and most importantly, a 9% decrease in motor vehicle crashes. And that, they estimate, the researchers estimated about 1,600 crashes were prevented in 1 year in New Jersey with this law.
Do you think this works, Tim?
Oh, I agree with Gary that the recent study that's been done of the New Jersey decal system, the evidence is very clear. But to go back to what the chief was saying, I think the parents need to understand GDL enforcement starts with the parents. I mean, there's absolutely no question about that. The police can only help. The parents and to some extent school officials are the ones that see the teens get or illegal amounts of teens get in the car in the first place, and they see the curfew violations. This is a parent enforcement job, number one.
From a police standpoint, if you see three teenagers driving through your town together in the car, are you able to pull them over at various times a day? Are you able to make a stop based on what you observe as perhaps is illegal activity?
No. Based on that, we would not have the probable cause to stop that vehicle just by seeing three teens in the car.
I want to get to a quick phone call. Katie's calling from New Haven. Hi, Katie. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. It's absolutely in support of what the law enforcement folks are talking about here. Parents are so much a part of the solution. And my two teen drivers tell me constantly that I'm the only parent in all of my town who actually forces the laws at home, both in terms of what time they can drive and passengers that they can't have, but also in our house, you can't get in a car with someone who's not legal to drive you. And they've told me how embarrassing that is, and I'm the only parent that enforces this. I know that's not true, but for any parent who's listening, I just want to tell you that you're not alone. We're in this together, and we have to support these laws. We have to keep our kids alive.
Katie, thank you very much for your phone call. And when we come back, we're going to be talking with Tim Hollister, whose book is Not So Fast, Parenting Your Teen Through the Dangers of Driving. He's going to be talking about his personal story of losing his son and also about what parents can do. We're also going to be talking more with healthcare professionals and law professionals. We're going to find out from you at 860-275-7266 how you're keeping your kids safe in the car. We'll be right back after this break, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about keeping teen drivers safe. A series of laws were passed back in 2008 meant to keep teen drivers safe, and they've been very effective. Now a number of people are wondering whether or not more laws need to be passed. We're talking today with Chief of Police from Farmington, the Director of the Injury Prevention Center from Connecticut Children's Medical Center, and also with author Tim Hollister, whose book is Not So Fast, Parenting Your Teen Through the Dangers of Driving. He's part of a task force that looked into these laws. In just a moment, we're going to be taking some more calls from I assume, a lot of parents at 860-275-7266. But Tim, tell us the story of how you got involved in this.
My son Reed was 17 when he died in a one-car crash in 2006. A year later, after some additional teen driver fatalities, Governor Relp appointed a task force to look overhaul the teen driver laws. And serving on that task force, I got a re-education in the dangers of teen driving. And I came to the conclusion that most of the literature that's available to parents doesn't explain why teen driving is so dangerous. and doesn't explain the steps that parents can take day by day before their teens get behind the wheel to prevent the most dangerous situations from happening in the first place. So my new book, Not So Fast, is basically explaining why teen driving is so dangerous, starting with things like brain development, explaining what a parent's attitudes should be, and then I go through a long list of steps. And this is all – this is not how to drive a car. This is parenting. This is before they get behind the wheel, what parents can do to prevent the most dangerous situations from happening.
What more can you tell us about Reed and how he died and how you were involved as a parent? Because I know this is a big thing that a lot of parents are grappling with us with right now.
Yeah. Well, Reed was a handsome, funny, energetic kid. He was an ADHD, attention deficit kid. He struggled in school. But his crash was on a stretch of road that I'm sure most listeners are familiar with. It's that long stretch of 84 East that starts in Southington and Cheshire and goes past the Hawks Landing Golf Course on the right. And then there's a very sharp turn between exits 33 and 34, almost a 90-degree turn. He went too far straight into the curve, overcorrected, inexperienced, probably over the speed limit, did two 360s spins and hit the butt of a guardrail right in the middle of the driver's side door, crushed the left side of his chest, and he died 5 hours later at Hartford Hospital. And, you know, my family and I had a long time, obviously, of grief and recovery. But, you know, serving on the task force was partly therapeutic and partly educational. But people ask me, you know, was the writing the book therapeutic? Well, I think the book is really public service because I saw these things in the literature that's available to parents. And I said, mostly this is teaching teens how to drive a car, and it's not explaining why teen driving is dangerous. So the public service was I felt like I had to get this information out there, give parents the benefit of the homework that I had done serving on the task force.
Was he driving by himself at the time?
No, he had two passengers. He had two passengers, girls from our neighborhood, who had a 10:30 curfew, and they were late. And we think that's why he was over the speed limit. So you think about it, a teen driver on a road he'd probably never driven before at night with passengers, that's a recipe for disaster. Now, what we do know, no alcohol, no drugs, no cell phone. He was well within the curfew. And at that time, his passengers were legal. They would not have been legal under the new laws that were passed in 2008.
There's a lot of things that we want to talk about on the program. But one, I want to come back to a show that we did just a few days ago. Dr. Lisa Namoro, who's a child and adolescent psychiatrist at the Institute of Living in Hartford Hospital, was speaking on Where We Live last Monday on our show about suicide risk in adolescents. Listen to a little bit about what she had to say about brain development.
Adolescents somewhere between 14 and 21 do stop using the thinking part of their brain to solve problems. So there is this unfortunate time period between 14 and 21 in which the cortex is not being used as well as it should be anymore.
And this is not a metaphor you're using.
This is true.
This is brain science.
This is brain science. Yeah. And so, again, we feel like we now have the neurobiology to the adolescent who says, when you say, what were you thinking? And they say, I wasn't thinking. We now know why.
Again, that's Dr. Lisa Namoro. And Tim, when I say this is not a metaphor, we were talking about the metaphor the parents will often use. Well, he wasn't using his brain at the time. And what she's essentially saying is, he wasn't using his brain at the time, in part because of the way biology works. And this is something that you write about in your book. This is very important for parents to understand.
It is. To apply what the doctor just said to driving, the last part of the human brain that develops is the part that gives judgment and restraint. And that doesn't really develop until about age 22 to 25. If you based the minimum driving age based on brain science, it would be at least 22 and maybe 25. So when I talk to parents about their teen drivers, I say, look, you can give your teen 10,000 hours of training. They can be an A student and a Boy Scout or a Girl Scout. It doesn't make their brain develop any faster, which is why my mantra as a speaker on this subject has become there is no such thing as a safe teen driver. It's nothing but based on their personality. It starts with the delayed brain development that parents can't do anything about.
Well, given that, Gary Lapidus, I mean, should we do something about it? I mean, should we actually look at the brain science and say 16-year-olds aren't equipped physically, emotionally, mentally, biologically to do the thing that we're letting them do?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Interestingly enough, many of the European countries actually license their young people older. If you look at countries in Europe, many of them licensed at age 18, 19. Now, it's not 22 to 25, and there are important reasons for that, but they do license later. And New Jersey, again, is one of the states that does begin this whole process later than other states.
Chief Melanson, well, one of the things that we were talking about during the break is this difference between 16 and 17-year-old drivers and 18 and 19-year-old drivers. You actually see statistically some differences here.
Yes, we have found since this law has been enacted that the 16 and 17-year-olds are actually having less car crashes. And now they're occurring in the 18, 19-year-olds. And part of that may be because of the distractions that we're talking about. There's such an emphasis from parents, from schools, about the 16 and 17-year-olds. And I think we've kind of then dropped off that once you've passed that range and now you're 18, okay, we lift any restrictions that may have been. And now all of a sudden we're seeing that those accidents are actually doubling when they reach that 18-year-old age group.
I want to get to a few phone calls, 860-275-7266. We have a call from Dr. Yanishevsky, who's calling from Glastonbury. Hello, you're on Where We Live.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
You know, this is a great show, and I'll tell you, the problem isn't a singular problem. It's a multifactorial problem that requires a multifactorial approach involving physicians, parents, the police department. I was part of a panel at a high school where we talked about drunk driving. And it was myself, a state trooper, an insurance person, and most importantly, a parent. And that parent held up a plastic bag with a ring and a watch. And that was all that was left of her daughter. And I'll tell you, that was the most powerful thing that those kids could have seen. The problem is that there were only about 50 kids and some parents there because it was not required. So part of the solution, why not a mandatory auditorium in high school before graduation where there is such a panel and they can get that kind of exposure? Monsanto will not solve every problem, but it certainly will make a dent. And I'll tell you, driving, it's a privilege. It's not a right. And parents have to know that.
Well, thank you very much for your thoughts. You know, Chief, when I grew up, we had those films that we'd sit in a large auditorium during the time that we were getting ready to drive, and they'd show very gory scenes of what happens to kids in a car accident. Of course, back in the 1970s and 80s when I was growing up, accidents were a lot more dangerous because cars weren't quite as safe. I wonder, from what the doctor who just called was saying, whether or not you think, as a law enforcement professional, that's something that works, essentially showing kids that this is what can happen and just telling them to be safer. Does that actually help?
You know, I sat through those same movies, and I think that scared straight type of tactic is not working with today's teens. I think really what we focus on is, rather than showing them gory pictures and videos and those sorts of things, is personalizing it. And it's bringing it home that it is somebody that they know.
Like the doctor was saying, I mean, essentially, this was what is left of my daughter.
Absolutely. Yeah. And having that parent speak to what happened to them. Every parent, every student knows somebody who was probably killed in a car crash. I mean, it's happened. You know, we look at the statistics in Connecticut and what's happened. And I think that by making it personal to them and realizing that this can happen here and this is what we need to do to prevent it, I think those are probably the best ways.
Tim?
We pay money to go to the movies to watch cars get smashed into little pieces and blood flying everywhere. There was actually an ad a couple years ago. Cars smashing into each other look better on high-definition television. What really resonates with teens are stories of the consequences to families and communities of what happens after a bad decision by a teen driver.
Well, but let's just talk about this. If we're going to talk about drugs and alcohol, we'll talk about texting while driving, a lot of different factors that go into this. The doctor who just called said multifactorial. Well, one is you get a chance to see an awful lot of car crashes. I mean, part of what the media is today is watching people do things in cars that seem like they're pretty easy to do until you actually get behind the wheel of a car yourself. Do you think, Tim, this plays any role whatsoever in the way kids actually approach driving?
Oh, yeah, certainly. We have a traffic culture in the United States, probably in the world, that glorifies driving. Cars are sold on TV driving on over cliffs and through walls and in shattering glass, and they do a 360 and they come to rest unscratched. I mean, certainly the media glorifies driving and gives you the impression that it's a no risk, even at high speed. So absolutely, part of the challenge for parents of teen drivers is to overcome the culture of traffic safety and driving in America.
Jordan's calling from Manchester. Hi, Jordan.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about how I was a teen driver, and I totally agree with everything that this radio station has to say today.
Were you ever involved in accidents yourself as a teen, Jordan?
Yeah, actually, I was 18 years old when I first got my license, and a few hours after I got my first car, I got into a car accident. Luckily, I was okay, but I mean, I was always with my friends and stuff. I was by myself. I was always with my friends, and you know, they were texting while they were driving, on the phone, you know, doing like multitasking while they're driving, and I just thought that I could do it. And it's just now, I, as an adult, I completely understand the laws that are in place now about cell phones and about, you know, no texting while driving. And I think that should really be enforced.
Well, Jordan, thank you very much for sharing that story. And yours is not the first time I've heard a story of someone really crashing within hours of getting their driver's license. This actually happens quite often. Gary, I know you wanted to jump in on what he was saying.
Yeah, I just want to, again, emphasize the fact that the research is very clear. Mock car crashes do not work. They have very limited short-term effect. There's no long-term behavior change. The story that was just told by the caller is emblematic of what happens. The kids, the teenagers, generally do not like graduated driver licensing laws. The parents do. But if you ask these same kids when they're 19, 20, 21, you get calls just like that indicate that they understand now how valuable and important graduated driver licensing systems are.
Really what we're trying to do is change the culture. And any time you do that, it takes a while. If anybody remembers back about 30 years, you know, seatbelts, I mean, really, people weren't wearing seatbelts. And I think in today, the data will show over 98% compliance. And the culture has changed to where you get in a car, you put on a seatbelt. So things have changed. But, you know, the driver brings up a good point about texting and driving and those sorts of things. And we talk about parents are primarily the educators of these drivers. I mean, that is, you know, so what you are doing in the car, your children will mimic.
Well, actually, Jane from Middletown, I think, is calling on that very point. Jane, go ahead.
Hi there. I have a great show. I have 21-year-old twin boys on the road and a 19-year-old who has his permit now. And what not one of you is mentioning is that the way the adult drivers drive on the road, the way police drive on the road daily, I see people breaking the law, tailgating. My 19-year-old will be driving. I'm sitting next to him, and he's doing the speed limit, and somebody flies up on his tail, and he gets all nervous. I think about that young man who died on 84. Anybody who's been on 84, you know, people are flying. They're intimidating you. Police officers are blowing an incredible chance to set an example. I was behind a state trooper from Higginham to Middletown who was tailgating the car in front of him. The person was getting nervous. The police officer was talking on the phone, did not use his signal, and then when we were at an intersection, he just slowed down and stopped at a four-way and didn't use his signal, and we were all supposed to guess what he was doing. I see this on a daily basis, and the adults should be ashamed. We are setting a poor example and intimidating the young drivers on the road.
Jane, thank you very much for that, and we just started getting into this conversation. Tim, I think she raises some very good points.
Absolutely. I always tell parents, if you have a newer model car that has a dashboard-mounted screen with interactive internet access and you're updating your Facebook page while you're driving, you're going to have a tough time delivering a message to your teen about texting because you're doing the same thing. And I think that's just one example of what Jane is talking about. I do want to add one little tiny linguistic point. The federal government uses the word crash, not the word accident, and they
Yes.
encourage all their agencies. I think we get a better message that every vehicle event is a crash was preventable instead of using the word accident. Small point, but something to think about.
We're actually talking about crashes. And just to her point, Chief, do you think police could set a better example? Look, we don't have a state trooper in here, but you know what? On that highway where his son was killed, I get passed by state troopers going 100 miles an hour. I know because I'm going 80 just to keep up with traffic. Can police set a better example?
Well, obviously, you expect your police to set an example. And, you know, if they are responding to a call, they should have their lights and sirens on. Obviously, there are some calls that they are going to. And obviously, riding 100 miles on the highway, that better be for an emergency. And obviously, as a chief of police, you know, we enforce that amongst our officers. And we have in-car video cameras, which automatically turn on when an officer goes over a certain speed, and our supervisors review it. And I'm talking about Farmington now. So when she talks about all police, I think we're using a broad brush.
Absolutely.
Everybody saw the video of what happened down in the southern part of the state in Milford with the officer who was in the crash, and they had the video of it. And, you know, that officer was arrested, and those are the consequences. Those are the videos that we show our officers to show your life can go from being on this side and trying to protect people and doing the right thing to all of a sudden, in a split second, there is a crash.
Gary, I know you wanted to jump in. I'm just wondering quickly, too, if you can address safe driving behaviors for adults and teens. I mean, you see crashes of all types in your field, and we see an awful lot of people who end up in the emergency room because they've been driving too fast. And these aren't just teenagers, but they've been driving very dangerously. This is a big part of our culture right now.
It is. And again, the public health view of motor vehicle crashes is just not focusing on human factors alone. We've done amazing things with making our vehicles safer and our roadway safer, and also changing the environment, as both Tim and the police chief have made. We live in a culture of fast and furious. There's one very tangible thing that parents and teens can do, and Tim talks about it in his book, and that's using parent-teen safety contracts. And I'll turn the mic over to Tim, let him explain what that's all about.
Yeah, in my day job, I'm a lawyer, so I brought a little bit of knowledge of contracts, but I took about 6 months and went through about 100 different models of contracts online around the country and pulled out what I thought were the best practices and also identified some things that I thought should not be in teen driving contracts. But I developed a national model, which is on the landing page of my blog, and it's also an appendix to the book. But what I try to emphasize is clear rules, understanding of risks right in the contract, and then a commitment to safety. A teen driving contract should be a collaboration, a joint effort between parent and teen. But it's an underutilized tool, but it sets clear rules so that in the wake of a crash, you're not having a heated debate about what happens. It's all right there worked out in advance.
And this is stuff that you can find at Tim's blog from Reed's Dad. His book is called Not So Fast, Parenting Your Teen Through the Dangers of Driving. And he's been working on this issue for years. Chief Paul Melanson is here. He's the Farmington Chief of Police. Gary Lapidus is from the Injury Prevention Center at Connecticut Children's Medical Center. We're talking about safer driving for teen drivers, what parents can do about it. We're going to get a lot of phone calls at 860-275-7266. Talk about some more things that are in Tim's book when we come back from the break, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, the race for governor is already heating up more than a year before election 2014. So who's providing the heat? Why, it's Republican Tom Foley, who's kicking off his campaign for Governor Malloy's job by throwing out some accusations and getting some accusations thrown his way. It seems like a job for the wheelhouse. Our weekly news roundtable, Colin McEnroe, as always, will join me. Dennis House from Channel 3 will be here as well. We'll tackle this and other stories of the week coming up on the next Where We Live. I hope you can join us tomorrow. I hope you can join me tonight. For the Connecticut Music Awards, I'll be presenting. A lot of the artists who have been part of our show over the course of the last couple of years will be nominated or getting awards tonight. It's happening at the Bushnell. Hope you can join us there as well. Today we're talking about teen driving. There's been a rash of accidents, crashes is the word that we're using today, that have killed teen drivers across the state. Trying to figure out what we can do about it after laws were passed back in 2008. We're taking your phone calls at 860-275-7266. Let's do this. Let's go to Jerry, who's calling from Monroe. A lot of people want to join our conversation. Hi, Jerry. Go ahead. Jerry, you're on the air. We're just going to move on from Jerry here and see if maybe we can get his line back. John is in Kensington. Hello, John. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. I have a proposal. I think that young drivers should have a sign on their car that has their number like trucks do with how's my driving. And if you see a young kid texting or driving 100 miles an hour, you call the 1-800 number. You say, I see car A452. This is the time of day. This is where I saw him. Call his parents and give him hell. We care enough about our cargo. Why don't we care enough about our children to do that?
John, thank you very much. Any thoughts about his plan?
Well, that's similar to the decal idea, and there's no question, I think, especially based on this Children's Hospital of Philadelphia study that Gary was talking about before, that a decal is an additional helpful step for law enforcement.
I want to get to something that I don't want to run out of time before I ask you about this. This idea of kids who have friends in the car. Obviously, we've seen the statistics that say it's more dangerous if you have one person in the car or two people in the car. There's more distraction. But one of the things that you're talking about, Tim, is this idea that driving someplace with a purpose is different than just going out driving. We spend a lot of times as kids just saying, hey, can I borrow the car? We're going to go out for a while. And what you're saying is that's inherently more dangerous than we're taking the car and we're going to a concert tonight. Explain a little bit about that.
Well, one of the things I try to do in my work and in my book is raise awareness of parents. And I find that when I talk about this topic, parents have kind of an aha moment because this is just below the surface of their consciousness. When teens have a destination, a route, and a consequence for not getting there on time, they're going to sports practice. If they don't get there on time, they have to run extra laps or do extra push-ups. They're going to drive carefully because they want to make sure they get there. Compare that with joyriding or recreational driving. Mom, I'm just going, taking the car for a couple hours to hang with my friends. That is when we see the risk-taking, the speeding, the peer pressure. I think I think six of the eight crashes that involve fatalities of drivers under 20 in Connecticut this summer were multiple teens in a car on what would be classified as a joyride. That is the dangerous situation that parents really should be preventing before their teen gets behind the wheel.
We've got some more calls. We're also getting tweets and emails. John writes, the driver's ed programs teach rote rule law memorization. They don't explain how to handle a skid, how to brake in an emergency, how to handle your car in a confident way. I think we've got another call. Jerry's back on the line talking about driver's ed. Hi, Jerry.
Hey, how are you? My son's going to be a teenage driver next year, and I know a lot of his friends and whatnot, and it's required to have your driver's ed before you get your license these days. But what I'm hearing and what I'm seeing is a lot of these kids are taking their tests at the driver's ed course. And if you're in a rural area, everybody's afraid to say go to like a Bridgeport DMV or a Danbury DMV to actually take your test in a local area or a non-familiar area. And then they're afraid to take their test. So they're taking tests that they're driving around their own streets and blocks, which in my case, I would say they would probably not even pass the driver's test if they were to take it in a normal area. And I believe that the tests that they're given are too lenient. They should be longer. They should be more explained, more in detail. They don't even go through a general basis of driving or certain situations. So I think the whole driver's ed thing is mostly relied upon the parents. And seeing what these driver's ed courses do, I think they should be more stipulations what they do out there.
Well, Jerry, thank you very much. What do we think about that? I mean, are driver's ed programs good enough, Chief, actually? Could they be better?
Well, I mean, obviously, any education in teen driving could be better. I mean, the reality of it is what we're testing is that they're competent to ride on the road. I mean, we're not saying that they're educated drivers and those sorts of things, and which is why some of these laws, the distracted driving laws, the passenger restrictions are there, because they need to focus everything on the task at hand, which is driving. So,
yeah, so I'll jump in on the driver's ed issue. There's been several carefully designed research studies that have looked at the impact of driver's education. And what people learn from driver's education is how to operate a car. There's no proven safety benefit. We're basically providing driver's education much like we've done in the last 30, 40 years. So I think, and many other people think, that we can really bring in new educational techniques, new technologies to really improve what's happening with driver's education.
I want to quickly get to Bob in Lakeville. We've got a lot of phone calls, 860-275-7266. Hi, Bob.
Yes, hello. This is Bob Green in Lakeville, Connecticut.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yep. Well, I think a lot of the point about driver education is we have additional restrictions, requirements, and the evaluation is basically the same as what I had in high school. And I run a program called Survive the Drive, and I've talked to 120,000 kids, and Tim and Gary are very familiar with this. But, you know, I think the outreach that groups like Impact that these fellows are involved with in my program, Survive the Drive, you know, are an outreach that's privately done to bolster what's done in by driver's ed and the parents. And, you know, I've always felt as though graduated licensing was the beginning rather than the end of the process to be able to teach these kids. And I make a side note that car crashes are actually the leading cause of violence on the planet, so that there are other countries in the world and other states around us that are implementing policies and factors and trying to get kids, you know, to be more heads up. You know, even if their brains aren't fully developed, we still have to concentrate on what it's going to take for them to learn, and the education and training, whether I go in and talk to the kids for an hour about the factors of behavior and physics, you know, that's something that may not be done by their parents or by the driver education process.
Well, and Bob, thank you for that. I just want to quickly get a response to that from Tim, and I knew you wanted to jump in on another point before, Tim.
Yeah, well, driver's ed does not produce safe drivers. It produces basic information about how to maneuver a vehicle on the road. But Jerry's earlier comment picks up on reason number four that I say there's no such thing as a safe teen driver. We train our teens in small cars on familiar local streets, and then they drive a high-performance vehicle or an SUV on the Mass Pike into Boston. So they're driving on unfamiliar roads. They're learning to navigate and to drive at the same time, which is another reason it's just almost an impossible challenge to think that they can drive relatively safely.
Not all cars are the same. You learn on one car, you drive in another car, very, very different sorts of things. Lynn's in East Granby. Hi, Lynn. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to mention that there was a lot of, on my part, concern about how other adults address getting your child to drive. When my daughter was 17, we went through the learner's permit thing, and then I stopped it because I didn't think she was mature enough to drive. And I can remember one of her friends' parents reaming me out saying, "What's the matter? Your baby," and coddling her. And he totally missed the point that my daughter was fresh, and I would offer her, "Do you want to drive? We're going to go to the store." "No, no." And then one time when we were going to go to an event that all her friends were at, she said, "I want to drive." And I said, "Wait a minute. Why do you want to drive this time? Is it because your friends are going to be there and you want to show off?" And she said, "Yeah, what of it?" And right there, I was like, that's the reason you don't do it. And then her friend's parents gave me a hard time. She'd also had eye surgery the year before, which is why I waited till she was 17. And when I brought her to the eye doctor, I said, "I want to be sure this is okay." And he said, "Oh, sure. I have people driving with one eye."
Lynn, I'm going to let you go just quickly because I know the chief wants to jump in on this. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think parents know their kids best. Just because we, by law, set a statute that says 16 years old, you know your kids best. So as far as whether they're ready for it or not, mentally, physically, and if they even are interested in it. And I'm seeing more and more parents waiting until 17 years old or older because they understand that their children are involved in sports, they're involved in so many other things, and they really need to focus on teaching them how to drive.
And just before we go, I want to say one thing. Jim in Oakville had wanted to make the point that I'd said that some of us drive 80 miles an hour to keep up with traffic. It's true. I've driven too fast. A lot of the people who called us today called from the roads. A lot of them were probably texting while they were driving. And I think one of the really key questions here is what can we do as people to set examples for young people on the road? I want to thank all of our guests, Chief Paul Melanson, Gary Lapidus from Children's Medical Center in Hartford, and Tim Hollister, whose book is Not So Fast, Parenting Your Teen Through the Dangers of Driving. Continue the conversation at our new website, WNPR.org. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.